Accession number 30505, Reel 3.
We were talking about the kind of uniform that you wore, Sandhurst General, and the last item, General Sir John Mogg, Reel 3. We were talking about the kind of uniform that you wore, Sandhurst General, and the last item, the dress uniform.
Yeah, well, the dress uniform, I'm getting slightly muddled now because I was commandant at Sandhurst, but later on in this eventful life. Well, of course, the dress uniform there was blue, but here, before the war, I described the uniform we wore practically every day for drill parades, which was sort of slightly baggy plus fours with khaki putties and highly polished boots, and you got your name taken if they weren't highly polished, and your putties, believe it or not, had to end and finish at exactly the right place, and all these little tiny messes of details all were part of the sort of military education that you had there. What I didn't mention, of course, was the be-all and end-all thing was the company unit that you were in, and as a senior under officer, you were the boss of that company unit from the cadet government point of view. And that was really, it was the competition for the champion company, which really led you to achieve more than you felt you could achieve, and everything counted practically for champion company. That perhaps is slightly unfashionable in certain areas now, is this competition side of it, but to our way of thinking at Sandhurst, it really did encourage you to really achieve the very best and never let the show down. And everybody tried their best, and I don't think the competition side of it did us any harm at all. And I believe in that competition. You've got to meet it everywhere in life. When you leave your school or your Sandhurst, you're going to leave it everywhere. And so I think you've got to get used to it when you're fairly young. And so competition was flat out.
Coming from the army and meeting students coming from other backgrounds, was this in any way a handicap?
Coming from the army... The few A cadets that came from the ranks, no, because I think you had an advantage. You were slightly older because you'd done a year or 2 years in the ranks. Secondly, your professional knowledge was streets above those that came straight from school. And I think one was lucky, in a way, to have had, I was anyhow, to have had some sort of education. I think nowadays there's a change. I don't know what the actual figures are, but I would have said that when I was at school that there were a very high proportion of boys, cadets at Sandhurst, came from a public school, from varying grades to the sort of top Eatons and Arrows of this world, right down to whatever you like to call it. So they're all public schools, mostly. I think nearly all of them came from public schools. Nowadays, when I was commandant at Sandhurst, much later on, I would have said there was a higher proportion of boys from state schools and other forms of education and direct from the ranks than there were from public schools. And so it's an interesting change in the sort of society in which we live. And it's just a follow-on from that, I think. I don't believe that it makes any difference where you come from. If you've got your character and professional training and leadership training put right, it doesn't matter where you come from, as long as you fit into the team. Probably later on in certain regiments who have certain traditions, some go for some thing, some go for another, and you want to live with people who think the same way, probably, and that makes for a better team. On the other hand, everybody, whatever ranks they come, if you take the smart regiments now, they don't all come from top public schools by any means.
Why do you feel there's been this change over the years?
Hmm?
Why do you feel there's been this change of background over the years?
I think it's why the change has been is because I think there's been a change in society, and I think perhaps there was a little criticism about the army having too many what you might call public school boys with the Oxford accent, and that became the army was slightly sensitive criticism in this area, and like everything else. I mean, I think society has changed in this way. I think in industry the same way. Perhaps it's a disadvantage sometimes to be in a public school in industry. If you speak with what you might call a sort of posh accent, you may not do quite so much the other way around. And I think that's not a bad thing. You've got to make your own way in life in that way.
At Sandhurst, what were the main areas of study? Did you study the great generals and their tactics and battles?
You certainly did military history. You certainly, that was one of the exams you had to take, was military history, which is the great generals and great battles. You had to certainly mathematics, a language. I stuck to my indescribable French. There were science, of course. It was very much a subject. Mathematics, as I said. History, English language. That was really about it. On the academic side, it was fairly, you know, the 3 hours straight through.
Was the military training very much as it had been in the army when you first joined?
Yes, very much so. I mean, the basic training. On the other hand, for the first time, I had instruction as a cadet in what you might call all arms training. In other words, that you got elements of the armored corps, elements of communications, elements of the air side of it, and so you were taught a great deal more in a wider sphere than you were just as a, you were within one regiment as another rank, and that we hoped to produce a slightly more balanced approach to didactics all the way through.
What was the relationship between yourselves as students and your tutors and your trainers?
Well, it was marvellous. Relationship. The officers, in a way, slightly stood back a bit, I think, and certainly for your first term, when you went through all the sort of drill, which I did really with the guards, and a tough training, that was mostly done by the warrant officers and the sergeants, instructors, etc., who were very specially picked and were the cream of the warrant officers and NCOs of all regiments. And they had that wonderful relationship by you call me sir, I call you sir, you know, that sort of attitude. And they didn't half smarten you up. I could tell you some splendid stories which are unrepeatable on this thing, but about how you got into trouble with the warrant officers. Yet, at the right moment, they were always very respectful because they realized you were going to be an officer. And so you had to be treated with a certain amount of respect. At the same time, you didn't half get smart enough. And that was a wonderful relationship, in fact. And somehow they seemed to react to that tremendously well, the warrant officers at Sandhurst, and I think their type of training is extremely good. You know, all the business of getting your hair cut, sir, and all that sort of thing. But it was very good. The officers were very, again, hand-picked at Sandhurst, always. You had the best officers, instructors. And so we were lucky in that respect. We had some very, very good instructors, and a very good relationship existed. We had a lot of spare time off at Sandhurst in those days. You don't now. My goodness, you don't now. Not enough, I don't think, in my mind, because you don't get a chance to do all the things that I think makes quite a good officer, which I think you would want to have, you know, to be reasonably relaxed, so that when the chips are really down, you've got something in reserve. You don't want to be flat out the whole time like some people are now. And I believe there's a tendency, you know, for everybody to say you've got to work from 6 in the morning to 12 at night. I don't believe it makes a particularly exciting sort of person, and I think the more you can get away and do things like skiing and riding horses and sailing and adventure training up climbing mountains and things, makes you a very much better citizen, and I think you're more relaxed. But not many people would agree with me.
What was the punishments? What kind of punishments did they mete out in Sandhurst?
Permit?
Punishments.
Policemen.
Punishments.
Oh, punishments. Punishment. Well, again, it's rather the same sort of thing. You got confined to barracks, but everybody was trying so hard to, you know, to succeed, and there was a terrific spirit of trying to not let the show down. There really wasn't much in the way of in any sort of crime at all. Perhaps you get the odd chap who gets went to a hell of a party in London and some nightclub and arrived back late. Well, all he would get there were extra drills and extra and confined to, but otherwise, no, hardly any punishments. As I can remember, I remember there was a thing called putty parades, which the under officers were allowed to dish out. If somebody turned up with a button missing, or he was idle at drill, or something like that, or had been an idle chap, hadn't cleaned himself up properly, then he would get 1, 2, 3, or 4 putty parades, which always happened very early in the morning, and you used to hear this terrible noise of people being chased around the square on a putty parade. That was the only sort of punishments there were, other than getting the sack. And that was very, as far as I can remember, I don't remember getting the sack when I was there. May have been, but I don't think so.
Was there much bullying at all of any kind?
No, none, hardly any.
What was the failure rate?
You got chased around the place, and that's what they would not bullying.
Failure
rate, I would think about 7%. of the cadets there, because they'd been through a fairly sort of good testing before they got there. I would think it was about 7. It certainly is about that now, I think, too, about 7%, because at Sandhurst now you have a thing which has started during the war called the Regular Commissions Board, which is at Westbury, and they see every officer candidate for 3 days on end, at which they do all sorts of tests, not only physical tests, but being able to speak in public and be able to discuss current affairs and to solve military problems, tasks which they have to do, and 3 days of testing, and that is quite difficult to get through. And so you have a fairly good sorting out there. Perhaps they don't, at the RCB, make enough allowance, and this is a debatable point, for immaturity. At that age, some are very immature, but will make very good officers. I always used to think that was the case until I became commandant at Sandhurst. Then I went down to Westbury, and I joined, as a general, I joined the actual syndicate at the RCB, and I didn't do the assault course because they thought I didn't want them laughing at the old general going down the assault course, but I joined in everything else in all the discussions, and I could see straight away when I went there, okay, you are going to pass, you are not going to pass, and there was a grey area in the middle, and with all the tests they did, you were going up and down, and eventually I reckoned that there were 3 that would pass and 4 didn't, and it was the other way down, around, but it was very close, and I think the system couldn't be faulted. On the other hand, I still think there should be some allowance made for immaturity. It's very difficult to fault it, and it's important to have that sort of thing. Well, that's really Sandhurst, isn't it?
Yes, I was going to ask you now how you came to be selected for the regiment that you were.
Well, having lived in Oxfordshire and having had an uncle and two cousins in the Oxford and Bucks Light Infantry, Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry, which was the 43rd and the 52nd Light Infantry. One battalion was in India and one was in England. I always wanted to join our own local regiment because I knew most of them. Even before I went to the Guards, and certainly knew some when I was in the Guards, and a lot of them came to my grandmother's house and that sort of thing, and as I said, I had relations in it, and so that was the plot. And so when I was at Sandhurst, you can put down for whatever regiment you like. You then get interviewed by the instructor or two instructors who are teaching at Sandhurst, and then you get interviewed by the colonel of the regiment. And if you pass those, then you're accepted. And if Sandhurst say you're good enough to go, you go. And so that's it. And on 1937, in September 1937, 2nd Lieutenant Billy New Mogg arrived at Colchester to the officer's mess of the Oxford Bucks Light Infantry, where I had the most marvellous time. This was, of course, you realise, is only 2 years before the war. And things were beginning to sort of hot up a bit then, because we realised that there could possibly be a war. And yet, at Colchester, with the regiment there, there were practically hardly any soldiers, because they were always being fed to the battalion that was out in India.
Which number battalion was this at Colchester?
43rd. 43rd battalion. 43rd regiment of Oxford and Bucks Light Infantry. And the 52nd was one out in India. And, I mean, I suppose it's like reflection on the army that we weren't really moving fast enough. But I joined in September. It's almost unbelievable. As second lieutenant, I went on holiday leave for 2 months in November and December. And as in those days, we had a soldier serve to look after you as a second lieutenant, and a groom to look after my horse. And I can just imagine what the taxpayer would be thinking about that now. And I came home, and the two soldiers lived in the local pub in the Hare and Hounds, and I lived here and went hunting on my horse and everything else. And that was the sort of life. You lived very well in the mess, fed extremely well. One spent an awful lot of time playing sports and things. And then occasionally, you would be doing some very tough manoeuvre on Salisbury Plain with the few chaps that you had. And most of them, you had to have flags to represent a section because there weren't enough men to do it. And it was all quite difficult. On the other hand, we had a commanding officer who was extremely good at teaching young officers. He made us work quite hard and write military theses on various things, and we had...
Who was this? Do you know his name?
Colonel Pargeter, who was the commanding officer at the time. I always remember him because my first confidential report, you know, officers have a yearly annual confidential report. And on my first annual confidential report, it was written in, I suppose, April 38. And I'd only really had about 4 months in the regiment. He'd sorted one or two of us out at sort of study periods we used to have. And my confidential read, Second Lieutenant Mogg is good in a crisis. Unfortunately, he normally creates them. that was my first report, and it wasn't terribly complimentary. However, I loved every moment of it. I was mad on the horses at that time, and I used to ride in races and go hunting, and there were lots of girlfriends up there, much to the dismay of my girlfriends, my old steady, who's now married to me. So we had a really marvellous time, and we learnt the elements of looking after your soldiers again, which I was in A Company. And then in early 39, when things were looking a bit bleak, they suddenly, if you remember, doubled the Territorial Army. And I, as a second lieutenant, was suddenly sent off to be adjutant of the new 5th Battalion of the Oxford Light Infantry in Oxford. And, I mean, adjutants to me were, you know, terrifying, the old and senior and everything else. I thought, good Lord. And so I went straight from second lieutenant to lieutenant and went off to raise the Territorial Army with a Territorial Army lieutenant colonel, Edmonds, Colonel Edmonds, who was a brewer in Banbury. Edmonds Beard, known to be very well, Maurice Edmonds, a marvellous chap he was, very nice and very quiet and very calm and very keen on the Territorial Army. And so I spent about 3 months then raising and interviewing people, interviewing officers and getting the same. Well, I had a permanent staff with a quartermaster, an adjutant, Territorial commanding officer, and about three permanent staff, warrant officers and sergeants. And we set the thing up. We had companies at Banbury, Chipping, Norton, Whitney, and Oxford. It was all very exciting, and the war was getting nearer and nearer. And suddenly I thought, it's time I got married if there's going to be a war. And so I went and asked my late commanding officer, the regular commanding officer, Pargeter, not Edmonds. Well, I did ask him, but he really wasn't. The regular chap was on the same. I ought to ask. And I asked him whether I could get married, and he said, can you support your wife? I said, no, sir. I can't possibly on 10 shillings a day, what it was I was getting. On the other hand, there's a war coming. He said, there's a very good reason. Off you go and get married. So we got married on June the 29th, 1939, and went for honeymoon in Ireland, of all places. First night at Legal Arms at Broadway, and nearly broke me just paying for the bill there, and it probably was only about £3 anyway. And we then went to Ireland, where I was married on fishing, and my wife had never been fishing at all. It was typical of a husband. And so she got so bored watching me, she started fishing, and then she's been very keen on it ever since. And then I was only allowed 10 days, because it looked as though the war was going to start. And I thought I was enjoying this rather much. I wonder if I could possibly have another 3 days and say, make some terrible excuse about a car or something. So we did, and... on the first day, it was okay. The second day, I began really worried what was going to happen to me when I got back. And the third day, I thought, well, my God, I'm bound to be court-martialed for being 3 days absent. And when I got back, I said, apologize very much to the commanding officer. I'm terribly sorry, I'm 3 days overdue. He said, oh, Lord, we weren't expecting you, Max, for another week. I nearly killed him.
can we go back to...
sorry, yes, I'm...
to the 1st Battalion, General. And you were received there, obviously. How was the officer's mess... how is an officer's mess organized?
Well, the officer's mess was meant to be very much like your own home. I mean, there was practically no formality there. The only person you called sir, in my regiment then anyway, was the commanding officer. And you probably called him colonel anyway, but either colonel or sir, not even the second in command. But, I mean, there were some wonderful old, real pre-war characters. I mean, some have been subalterns for 18 years. You think that I went from second lieutenant to lieutenant in a period of 3 months. And yet some had been lieutenants for 18 years, and they'd all been used to the sort of, quite a lot of them were bachelors. One old second in command, who I devoted to, really, but he was quite a character. And the very first morning I came down to the mess for breakfast, I helped myself a wonderful display of eggs, bacon, kidneys, goodness knows what, and I sat down to him, and I sat opposite, and I said, "Good morning, Charles." I'd met him before. And he was reading the Times, and he took no notice, and I then sort of looked up again and said, "Good morning, Charles," in a slightly louder voice. He put his paper down, and he said, "Never, never, never speak to me at breakfast." And that's the time we've got. We were all very happy to party, really. And
did you have some kind of funding to find for them?
Funding? Well, you paid a mess bill, and it was unbelievably cheap. I mean, we lived fairly well, but unbelievably cheap in those days. You had a civil servant to look after you. I had Smith, 88, he was known. He came from Liverpool. He had real scars, and he was, absolutely devoted sort of person. I worshipped him, too, and I hope he worshipped me. I don't know. He's a poor chap. He's not alive now. And we made real seriously long-standing friends with all our colleagues, which are still lasted, those that have still survived the war, and still to this day we see a lot of each other. So there was a great spirit amongst it.
Who was it that ran the mess?
Well, you had a mess sergeant, Sergeant Darlow. He was a bit of a disciplinarian when you were a very young officer too, because if you came in down to breakfast about what he thought would be late, would be 8:30 or 8:45, he would say, "Sorry, sir, no breakfast for you, sir. You're late, sir." You see, and he was the boss chap, so he went about the boss. So it shows the sort of line that the importance of people. Whereas the regimental sergeant major was also a tremendous king. I always remember that he had he was a rattle snob to him. He was did keen on talking to the officers, but he wasn't very good with the other ranks. And I had an old bull terrier with me, and he was also a snob too. And one day, regrettably, he bit the regimental sergeant major. And that was the most disastrous thing, because both being snobs, he only bit my dog, he only bit the soldiers. And so the sergeant major wouldn't speak to me for about 3 weeks afterwards. However, those are just the little characters that were about. We had a lot of horses in those days still, kept, some of them were kept by the government, really for the use of officers to ride at all. And he used to call them 15 bobbers. You can hire them for a month, for 15 bob a month.
What kind of duties did a young officer new to the battalion perform?
Well, I was made assistant weapon training officer, which meant that you ran all the weapon training with the weapon training officer, who was a great friend of mine, is still alive now. I see a lot of every day. Well, not every day, but once a week, certainly. He's still around here. And
what was his name?
Henry Van Strapinski, a good old English name. Dutch, really, but he good old English. His father was general in the gunners, and a great man. And where do we go to now?
Duties and responsibilities.
Duties and responsibilities, that's right. Well, as there were so few soldiers there, I mean, you could run weapon training classes for the SEAL soldiers that were there and take them up shooting on the range. You had to pay them. You would have to go around being orderly officer to make sure that you inspect the guards and that sort of thing. Otherwise, there wasn't really a great deal to do. It wasn't until I got to the 5th Battalion as a territorial soldier that we really started to work, because we had to train these chaps straight from the streets, so we really worked pretty hard indeed. And there we did, then the war broke out and started, and we were then guarding vulnerable points down in the south coast at Southampton. And then suddenly we moved to Northern Ireland, where we trained and trained and trained and trained with all arms and infantry training and everything else. Marvellous training areas and the mountains up there, and we were stationed at Castle Rock and Coleraine, and then we moved to the famous McGilligan Point, which was now featured in the IRA campaign, and which was a sort of camp right on the coast.
Was there any problems with the IRA at this time? How were the people of Ireland receiving it?
Well, the IRA was about, but I mean, you didn't really know it. The only experience I saw of the IRA, well, no, there were the odd sort of see, being such an enormous amount of the army over there, training, that they really didn't have a look in. But there were the odd sort of explosions that would have set off occasionally. But nothing serious. And the only contact I had, I remember that we were at McGilligan Point, and there was a very large estate nearby, which belonged to Major McCausland in the Irish Guards, and he was away with the Irish Guards. And he said, if you ever want to go fishing in the river there, just go whenever you like. And I was fishing one day. We worked so hard, I only had one Saturday afternoon and went there. And a little man came up to me and said, and what are you doing? I said, I'm fishing. And he said, you shouldn't be here. I said, it's all right. I got permission from Major McCausland to come in. He said, it doesn't belong to Major McCausland. It belongs to me. So I said, well, I'm terribly sorry. I must be in the wrong place. I'll move further up the river. He said, now you're here, you'd better stay. And he said, you see the wee farmhouse over there. If you feel like a cup of tea at 5 o'clock, come and have a cup of tea. And I went across there. Cup of tea consisted of a bottle of Irish whiskey, and we got through about half of it, I suppose. By this time, he was getting very matey indeed, and he was saying, now, Major, he says. I said, how do you know I was a Major? He says, well, you're up there at McGilligan. I said, yes, I am. And he said, you're putting up the fences there to stop the Germans coming. I said, I am. And he said, I'll tell you something else, Major, he says. I'm a member of the IRA. And I said, no, you shouldn't tell me that. I'm not supposed to talk to you boys. And he said, well, I'll tell you something else, Major, much more interesting. He says, when the Germans come, our orders are to shoot all you police officers in the back, but wherever you want to come fishing, you come fishing whenever you like. I thought that was a typical of the IRA today. However.
So with the onset of war, with war coming, what were the signs that were actually showing themselves with war approaching?
Well, when the first sort of sign of violence, if you like, is that we were married, and as an agent, I told you I was agent in Oxford, and we lived in a little flat in the High Street in Oxford on the corner of the Terle and High Street. Am I talking nonsense? No, the Terle. Yes, the Terle, just around the corner by the Terle. And the first thing that happened was I went out to dinner the night before the war started, and I didn't know the war was going to start that day, but it happened during that night. And the telephone rang, and somebody asked for me, and I heard down the voice somebody saying, Cromwell. I said, yes, what are you talking about? He said, Cromwell. I said, I don't know what you're talking about at all. He said, Cromwell, Cromwell, Cromwell. I said, you must be drunk, and put the thing down, you see. And of course, suddenly when I left there, I realized this was the code word. This was the war started. So I then shouted to him. He said, come on, quick, let's get in the car and go back. So I went back to our headquarters, where the whole place was buzzing. And then all of the VI, the vulnerable points that we occupied, all had to be on alerted, and people were stood to. And the first thing that happened, I think, that I remember in the war was at about 10 o'clock that morning, the sirens went. And it was the most awful sort of noise. We then suddenly realized we were at war. It was a rather nasty sort of feeling. And we were only in Oxford for a very short time, and then we went down to the south coast, and we were then stationed in Dover and Southampton, in various places all the way along. And I remember the first sort of thing that made us, we had a shell landed in the middle of the Old Park Barracks in Dover. One of the heavy guns from the French coast, fired by the Germans, landed in the middle of the square at Old Park Barracks. Luckily, it did no damage at all, except broke a few windows. That was my first shell, being under fire.
How did you feel about the state of training of your battalion?
Well, it was terrible. But then, from that moment, we suddenly, as soon as Dunkirk was over, we dashed off to Ireland, and then we solidly trained, absolutely flat out. I believe we were the best. We'd had nothing but training for about 2 years in Northern Ireland. And I believe we're almost the best trained battalion. And you were talking about marching earlier on. We marched 52 miles in 22 hours, 20 minutes, which was really to try and defeat the length of miles that Sir John Moore marched in the Peninsula War. But they were carrying like a heavier pack than we were. But we were tremendously well trained and very, very fit indeed. And we never stopped training all day long. What happened then after that? Well, we did all this. I went from adjutant to company commander to second in command of the 5th Battalion. And then I was sent down to Margate to go and command a battle school, which we had in those days, which was training platoon and company commanders.
What rank did you hold at this time?
I was then a major as second in command. And then I had already been twice to my divisional commander of the 61st Division, General Brown Wainwright, and before him, General Carton de Ward, a very famous character with one eye and one arm, one leg, practically two, but he was Marv's man. But both of them I had been to. I said, look here, I'm a regular officer, sir. I must go and fight the war. I mean, this is ridiculous. And they both said, don't you worry, it'll come soon enough.